As all of you know, most of you know, we're in the process of finalizing, closing the escrow on a property in Half Moon Bay, a beautiful farm that will soon be Ananda Farm and roll on for many generations, I think, as another holy site for Master's work. It's really quite remarkable. I've been engaged in the last week or two with Lisa and Jill going over legal documents, because whenever you start getting involved with other people's money, not only do you have to do a great many things to be careful about it, but there's also all these laws that have to be met, and then there is an enormous convention, which is actually based on litigation, which is based on preventing litigation, which is that if every single thing and every single possibility and then every iteration on that possibility and then every iteration on that iteration is explained in advance, the type gets smaller and smaller, except every so often it gets real big and then it gets real small again. And all of these things are explained, then we'll be safe. We'll never be sued, and if we're sued, we'll be fine. Okay? So, having been a veteran of Ananda's litigation for more than a decade, it's not like I'm a stranger to these things. Although our attorney described my initial reaction when I got the first 32-page document, a very small print, as allergic. She described my reaction to her other attorneys as that she had an allergic reaction to it. It took me a little while to sort it out, and I finally said, no, it wasn't allergy, it was moral outrage. It was much worse. And then later when I was talking on the phone to the attorney, we got a very good business lawyer, which is one of the reasons that there's so many pages and the print is so small, because he's accustomed to dealing in Silicon Valley with very complicated situations. We tried a first lawyer, and he just basically said, too many factors here, and he suggested we go up the food chain, which we did. Then I was talking to her on the phone, and she said, well, everybody who gets this document will want to take it to their own attorney and to their own CPA. And that was just like, so I had another allergic reaction to that. I said, that's exactly what I don't want to have happen. And she read into it quite the natural thing, and she said back to me, oh, you're just like any other entrepreneur. You don't, and because I said it'll just make them frightened. That's what I said. They'll go to a CPA, and the CPA will say, what's in this for you? And the answer is not much, okay, if you're just looking at the dollars and cents of what you're going to get. And I said, it'll scare them off. And she said, you're just like anybody else. Everybody else I deal with, nonprofit, profit-making, are all just the same. In the end, you just don't want to scare away the money. And I was so taken aback by that thought that I thought, well, that's interesting. And I said, well, maybe so. But then I began to think about it later after I got off the phone. And I am reactive. Everybody who knows me knows that I can be a little quick off the starting line. And then sometimes I have to retract. If you're a little quick off the starting line, you get good at apologizing. So, you know, vice and virtue, they work together. But I really, really wanted to think, what was it about this that's so disturbing to me? And I realized that it goes contrary to everything that I feel like both Ananda and all of us who are devotees of Master have devoted our whole lives to. And for the sake, I wrote a letter to the attorney, just, you know, hoping she doesn't charge me by the hour to read it. But I just felt like I needed to tell her what I was really thinking, and it's this. The whole spiritual path is about understanding that we are part of a greater reality. It's a simple way to say it. When we have the points, the 7 points that describe the way of the Ananda Sanghi, what does Ananda Sangha stand for? The first is that we all emanate from the same source, and that source is Sat Chit Ananda, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. That is the one reality pervading all of creation. That is the only reality there is in the end and in the beginning and in the middle, and that our duty, not duty is an insufficient word, the only reason we were born is to be a manifestation of that, a conscious manifestation of that, to realize who and what we really are. We call our whole work self-realization with a capital S, making a big distinction in English, because there's no English words to say exactly what we mean, from the little self that we normally identify with, the one that has to pay its bills and has to take care of its health and worries about its position in life and watches itself age and wonder if it will be a burden to its children, and all of those little things that are all the characteristic of the little self, which we deeply identify with and which everybody identifies with as a whole society, to such an extent that they don't even think it's odd. It's just in the same way, and I don't mean to cast aspersions on those of you who are not vegetarians, but when I sit in a restaurant and I see a family dining together and the father's having a little chicken on his plate or maybe a hunk of beef or something like that, my first thought is, you're not going to eat that in front of your children, are you? You know, like, I mean, maybe in the privacy of your own home, but in a public place when young ones are around? But of course, it's so common that no one thinks of it as a dead animal. You know, little children are often very shocked when they discover that the meat that they're eating is actually a dead animal. We had quite a hoo-ha in our school one year because somebody actually came in and talked to the children about that they were eating dead animals. And they went home to their parents, and their parents didn't like the result of that whole experience because they were quite accustomed to eating dead animals, and it just didn't make sense to them. Anyway, so I recognize that what we consider abnormal is considered totally normal, and I'm not talking just about vegetarianism. I talk about defining yourself by the limited self. And in fact, we're always, you know, we have to be practical about things. You really have to be practical at all times, meaning you have to think about yourself, you have to take for yourself, you have to get for yourself. I mean, you can move up the food chain, so to speak, from just that, but it's so common that no one thinks it's unusual. And in fact, people work hard to get better and better and better at it. And it's considered to be a very positive thing to be very good at it. This very expensive lawyer we're using is extremely good at making sure in every single angle everything is protected and so that nothing is left to chance. It's the world we live in. I'm not so naive as to think that we can just sort of, you know, get a piece of scratch paper and say, here's my money, yes, we got it. You know, more than that is required. But the whole mindset behind it is something else. And my concern when somebody takes these 32 pages to their CPA and then we start talking about the nature of this investment, which is perfectly safe in the sense that it's perfectly honest and there's not going to be any loss, but no, you're not going to make the best return on your money. It's a good karma investment. And it's also a safe haven in a very real sense. I'm not going to try to sell it to you now. I've done so much of that. And you all have responded so wonderfully. I don't need to go into it. But what's going to happen is this tender plant, which is the tender plant of there is a divine force in this world. And that divine force is a mother to me. And I can trust that divine reality as long as I do my part. And you must understand, my part is not the practical part. My part is to really live by those principles. I was talking to someone recently, a young man who's, you know, off on an adventure to try to really commit his life to serving Master's work. And he had natural financial concerns and so on like that. And I said, look, this works in only one way. It has to be 100%. You can't on one hand say, I trust you, God, but I'm just going to make sure, you know, that a big part of me, and I'm not just talking about whether you have a little income on the side. I'm talking about in your own heart. You know, do you really believe that you have a relationship with God and Guru? And if you live according to the high principles of Dharma, that this is a loving mother that you're relating to. Just like Jesus, when he was trying to convince the corruption of Judaism. The Jews were caught in a corruption, and that's why Jesus came. And he said, if you ask of your father, your earthly father, a loaf of bread, will he just give you a stone instead? He was trying to get them to understand that this God with whom we are connected, this Satchidananda, is there to take us where we want to go and to give us everything that we really long for. But in order to do that, a great many other premises have to come into play, which is we have to become concerned for a reality greater than ourselves. We have to become instruments of a higher consciousness. If we are fortunate enough to be connected with the divine path, we have to become the servant of that divine path. We can't just sort of sit back and say, well, you know, I know Master's here to transform the world. Good luck. You know, in our position of focusing the energy and sometimes leading the energy, I'm always watching the nuances of this. And at a certain point, collectively, the Sangha staff and the ministerial staff, we realized we needed to stop thanking people for donating. Oh, thank you for your donation. Because that caused people, even who'd been part of this group for a very long time, I mean, I was shocked when somebody came up who's been part of us for 20 years and said, did you raise the money you needed? I said, did I raise the money I needed? Like, why is it not the money that we needed? Why is the question not, did we raise the money that we needed? And then I realized, well, somebody's always writing a note. Thank you. It really helped us. So we've been trying, instead of writing thank you notes, to write congratulation notes or celebration notes or victory notes. Just to get the mind in a thousand little ways, you see, the ego just creeps in and tries to take a little bit back. And that song that we often sing, The Temptation of Christ, it takes a little while to hear the words because the first singer sings as Satan, and he says, you can have anything you want in this world. God will give you anything you want if you just reclaim what you've given. And then you can have anything. And Jesus in the song responds, get thee behind me, Satan. This is taken, of course, from that beautiful story in the Bible when Jesus comes out of 40 days of fasting and was tempted of the devil. And the devil said, God will give you anything you want. You must be hungry. Just demand of him bread. Use the power that you've gained to take for yourself. And Jesus says, no. He says, if you cast yourself down from this high place by the power that you have gained, God will save you. And Jesus says, no, my life belongs to God. I'm not going to reclaim for myself my power, my hunger. It has to be a complete commitment. And then, of course, that's not easy to do. The ego always wants to just play both sides of it. You know, just a little bit, I'll do just a little bit here, but in my heart, my real security comes from the fact that I didn't give them all my money. And it's not necessary that you give all your money unless you really feel inclined to do so. If you have children to raise and it doesn't feel like a sincere offering on your part, but just a slightly fanatical affirmation of a consciousness you don't have, you know, that's why when we ask you to donate, the first thing we say is meditate on this. Pray to God. Feel what he is calling you to do. And many of you who have been very generous realize that that is a reality. That's a relationship. It's not just saying I have 100,000 in the bank, I'll write a 100,000 check. It's I meditate on it and I feel what God is really calling me to do because he has our best interests at heart. And above all, he doesn't want us to practice what I call boing back yoga. Remember those little, I used to have a little paddle toy that you had like that, had that long rubber string on it, and you do it like that and it would bounce out. But no matter how far it went out, it always boing back, right? And sometimes if we stretch ourselves harder, then our true reality can support. We just go way out and then come back. What we really want to do spiritually is we want to expand in such a way that every step we take becomes a perfect and never-ending forward movement. So we try to feel our attunement rather than imposing on this from the outside. But always there are two forces. There's the force of, well, there's no other word for it, Satan. That force of Satan, which I'm not thinking so much of the devil with his little horns, although that doesn't hurt sometimes to just think about it. One of my favorite expressions for myself is, the devil made me do it. It's just a nice, sometimes you just do things that are so loony, afterwards you can't understand why you ever thought of doing them. So I always say, the devil made me do it. Just some kind of madness overtook me for the moment. And in that moment, it seemed like a good idea. Because that force of habit, that force above all of fear, that concern, what's in it for me? And you see, the problem with all that thinking, the really serious problem with all that thinking is in the end it doesn't work. That no matter how hard we try to make our own little universe secure forever, untouched, nothing can bother it, this is what I've got, I have it all wound up, something always happens. And if you manage to skate through an incarnation or two, sooner or later, you see, it's not the truth. We appear to be separate, but we are absolutely, utterly integrated. Not only our individual with the infinite, but all of us together. We're just one reality. Everything emanates from Satchitananda, and the closer we live to that reality, the more every aspect of our life is in harmony with that reality, that's the only security there is. And that's why I have devoted myself from as early as I began to understand this to doing everything I can to inspire, to persuade, to help, to support other people in just moving inch by inch by inch. Because really, that 32-page document, no matter how carefully worded, will not really protect a single person from unhappiness. It may allow you to win the lawsuit if it comes, or prevent the lawsuit if it was going to come, and understand exactly what the tax aspects are. And even you have to write in there that these are the laws now, but the laws might change, and then everything in this document won't mean anything. I mean, I won't have an allergic reaction. I could break out into hives right here, but I won't. Okay? But the problem with all of that is the regular practice of Kriya, a generous concern for the welfare of others, a willingness to sacrifice your own interests to support the causes that you believe in. The very definition, Swamiji said, when someone asked him once, you know, what kind of ministerial training do you have in Ananda? And he said, the definition of a minister is a person who is able to think, even in the midst of their own trials, first of the welfare of others. Why would such a thing be asked of us? Jesus says in the Bible, it's more blessed to give than to receive. But he didn't mean, oh, I actually get more in the end. I give away a dollar and then I get $10. You know, it's more profitable to give than to receive. He meant blissful. That's the word he meant. It's more blissful to give than to receive. And we touch that. We feel that. A generous heart is a happy heart. If we're always outgoing with our energy, if we have ideals that we believe in enough, to actually commit ourselves to, by our daily meditation, by our deep devotion to Master, by our willingness to pray, not merely what do I want, but how can I serve? And here in the Bhagavad Gita today, first we have the famous lines from Jesus, cast not your pearls before swine. You know, don't waste your breath trying to persuade people who are not interested. But then the Gita defines that more, because you can't always recognize swine. You know, some swine look really nice. Some swine are actually quite attractive. But he puts it this way, Krishna puts it this way, to those who lack self-control. And he's not talking about those people who live in monasteries necessarily. Self-control, the self we're trying to control, is the rapacious self-interest. The one who only has the thought all the time, what's in it for me? Even when I was younger, one of the first things that really impressed me when I read on the spiritual path was, don't think about yourself and you'll be a happier person. And I was and always have been generous by nature and enthusiastic, and enthusiasm likes to share. So it wasn't so much that I hoarded my marbles just for myself, but I was always calculating my own position. I was always asking, what would I enjoy the most? What would be the most fun for me? How can I be where I especially want to be? How can I follow my own interests? And when that thought came that I wouldn't always be, and in my own teenage way, because I was just out of my teens when I read that, I was always calculating my own advantage. I had defined my advantage an inch or two up from the bottom of the food chain, but nonetheless, the orientation of my thinking was always my own advantage. And my own advantage was defined by whatever it was that I thought would make me happy. It never entered my mind to think in terms of Divine Mother's guidance to me, the guru's interest, serving a greater cause. I had a desire for those things, but the biggest cause I knew about was my own enjoyment. And so the self-control that we need to exercise is the self-control that's born of the intuition and the growing understanding that this is not really my self-interest. That my self-interest is to serve the divine. That my self-interest, it is more blissful to give than to receive. It is more blissful to serve than it is to always be calculating what's in it for me. So Krishna says, don't even try on the spiritual path. But what he's saying in reverse is, these are the basics of the spiritual path. You must have the capacity, or at least the sincere intention, to discipline that small self to the service of the greater self. And then he says, what's also required is devotion. Because without that heart relationship to it, the mind is still always calculating. I mean, talking about these papers again, I think the single quality they lack the most would be the word heart. You know, there was no heart in them. I talked to Shivani on the phone, who had to do all the investments for the movie too, and I was lamenting about this. She has more determination than I do. She said, I rewrote them. She also did 2 years of law school, so she had a position. I rewrote them. The two of us just sort of were like that, like, wow, what a story. But there has to be heart. It's just as David was reading today, concentration comes when you're interested in something, when you love it. And when we have these experiences of the devotion to the masters, which we often have in this very temple and you have in your own meditation rooms, when you have that devotion makes the mind so much clearer, doesn't it? Love finds reasons for unity. And when there's love, there's always this ability to sort of see how it's all really going to come together in harmony. And if we don't have that belief that it's all going to come together in harmony, then of course we always have to make sure that I'm okay. Because most stories have an unhappy ending and I don't want to be the one. So I'll just calculate my advantage and I'll make it work. We have to have self-control. We have the willingness to make the effort and the devotion to the cause. And then he says, and seva, service. And what is service really? I know Shanti, in her enthusiasm, and she's been a wonderful asset in this respect, because she, as a physician, as a medical person for much of her life, she's really understood the idea of service. And she's really understood it's blessed to serve. And it's not a question, again, of what I get, whether I'm getting paid and this or that. It's that if I have talent and energy and ability, and I can use that for the greater good of all, that's no difficulty. That's just pure joy in doing it. There was the story that of Master teaching one of his disciples, and she had this consciousness of work, is how he put it. And Master wanted to break her of that habit. And so he just kept telling her that you work much too much. You're always working. You really need to work less. And then he would give her more to do. Master didn't usually sit you down and talk to you about it. He pushed you until you could understand. Then he gave her more work to do. So she was working all the harder and all the more frantic. More work and more work. And finally I think these are the same story, I might have them confused. Master was working in the kitchen and he was cooking. He often cooked in the kitchen. And she was helping by cleaning up every little thing after he used it. And so then he started to work faster and faster, and he started using more and more things, and sloppier and sloppier. So she was frantically running along behind him trying to clean up, and he was making bigger and bigger messes. And finally she realized what was happening. And she just sat and waited. And she realized, as soon as she sat, he began to cook in a more normal manner, you know. And finally she understood, and the other woman understood. "Sir," she said, the woman who'd been buried under work. "Sir," she said, "why don't, instead of calling what we do here work, why don't we call it service?" And he said yes to her. He said, "You've been spending your whole life thinking work, 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 work." He said, "How much sweeter it is when we think what we're doing is service. And everything that we're doing is service. That's all we are. We're here to serve the divine cause. As devotees, we have a conscious cause that we can serve. We're serving it. And I don't want the people to take the paper to the CPA, not because I'm afraid that the money will go away. If the project is meant to be, the money will be there. I'm not going to try to persuade someone against their own feeling. But the CPA is not going to ask them, 'Do you believe in this cause? What is your experience of this guru? You know, how do you imagine that property is going to serve the world? You know, what do you see as the good karma benefit of doing this?' You know, those questions won't even arise. And it's not that the questions he's asking are bad questions. I'm not trying to take away their professions. You know, I said to the lawyer that I'm working with, "I'm glad I have you to work with. You're very nice and intelligent and a good person." But it's a different universe. It's a whole different way of living our lives. And there's a certain point on the spiritual path where we have to say, I'm not doing what you're doing. I'm not doing what you're doing. I'm doing something else." That's why Swamiji put us in blue. When he put us in these blue clothes, which we wear all the time now, I wear them all the time. And David said, "Sir, we've spent 25 years in Palo Alto trying to fit in. If we start walking around looking like this, we're going to kind of stand out, aren't we?" Swamiji's answer was, "Well, maybe it's time to stand out. Maybe it's time, instead of pretending that we're living like everyone else, to make it very clear that we're not. Not for any egoic reason, not for any reason that says we're doing something better." Well, yes, I have to be honest. Of course we're doing something better. But not better in the sense that you'll go to hell and we won't. We have the true path and our guy is the greatest. You know, none of that. Better because more blissful. Just better because more blissful. As simple as that. All of you have told me, and you know it yourself, "Oh, this has happened to me, and this has happened to me, and this has happened to me." I mean, you know, the problems of life, or my sister, or my mother, or my children. But somehow, on this path, we're not alone. And if we don't want to feel alone from God, we have to be with God. If we want Divine Mother there to support us in our hour of need, we have to have that self-control, that devotion, and that service. It is blessed, more blessed to give than to receive. It's very, very good advice. Generosity of heart. That's what the masters want from us, and truthfully, that's what our soul wants from us as well. It's what we want for ourselves. How fortunate that we have so many opportunities to live this way. God bless you.